Well, I appreciate Joe leading that song just before the sermon. He had other song planned, but I asked him if he would lead that one. For in some ways, that provides us for the thought for the lesson this evening. You'll remember that first verse, time is filled with swift transitions. Naught on earth unmoved can stand. Build your hope on things eternal, hold to God's unchanging hand. Life is indeed filled with swift transitions. That's one of the things that I guess we notice most about life are the changes that take place. Just to look around the congregation here at this time of the year, we have experienced considerable transition. All the northern members have gone back to their homes up in Ohio and elsewhere, no longer with us. Many of the students have left and are not with us anymore. And of course, this is the time for travel. So we have a large number of our group who are away at various times during the course of the summer. Transition that occurs in the congregation. More than that, individually, many of you are facing transitions in life, significant transitions. The birth of a child, marriage, changing jobs, new home, different schedules that we face. There's something about life that just is characterized by transitions and sudden changes and unpredictable changes, too. One of the things that people like to talk about very much wherever you go, and I've been fortunate to travel a little bit around this country, and people everywhere talk about their weather as if it were different than the weather anywhere else. And in every part of the country, they almost always seem to own or feel they own this expression. There's one thing about the weather around here. If you don't like it, just wait a while. It'll change. Because as somebody said, that's the thing about seasons. They change. There are changes in the seasons of our lives. And most of us have some kind of misgivings probably about those changes that occur in our lives, because in many ways we have no way of knowing what those changes are going to be or what the changes are going to bring. We can't see the future. And in some ways that may be God's gift to us, that we can't see the future. Many times we'd like to see the future. We'd like to know what tomorrow holds, or we'd like to know what years down the road hold for us, but we just don't know. And in some ways, God has designed life exactly that that would be the case. The debater, the preacher, the wise man in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 considers these transitions that occur in life and the lessons that we might draw for them. And particularly in Ecclesiastes 7 and in verse 14, he suggests that you should look at these transitions that occur in life in this light, Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 14, in the day of prosperity, rejoice. In the day of adversity, consider. And then he goes on to express something about what we might consider. God has made the one as well as the other so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. Isn't that an interesting passage? Two pieces of advice that seem relatively easy, at least the first one, and then a lesson that he draws from that, that God made both adversity and happiness for us. And he did it for this particular purpose, that you will not know what is going to come next in your life. If you're happy today, that's no guarantee that you're going to be happy tomorrow. Adversity does come. Rain falls into every life, as the poet said. There's a sense in which if you are unhappy today, you may very well expect that's not going to continue, but you don't know what the future is going to hold. God intends that we should not know what's going to happen. Changes occur, dramatic changes and reversals of the situation that we experience. In fact, that's almost the history of the Bible and the history of the people who the Bible writes about. A shepherd boy who fights with a giant and kills him and becomes king. And then who is run from his capital city by his son, David, a life filled with dramatic changes. Our great king over the mightiest kingdom in the history of the world to that point in time, who is turned out and eats grass in the field like an animal, Nebuchadnezzar. Our prisoner far from home, lonely in his jail cell, who is called up to the Pharaoh and becomes second in command, Joseph. Or a nobleman who is proud and haughty and certain of his position and who builds a tall tower to hang his mortal enemy on, and yet he is hung on that tower, Naaman. Those transitions are just what the Bible is all about. A man who was the son, as it were, of the daughter of Pharaoh, who becomes exiled for 40 years in the land of Midian as a poor shepherd, and then comes back to stand before the next Pharaoh and to say, "Let my people go." A tax collector to whom some wandering rabbi says, "Follow me," and he leaves it all behind and becomes a fisher of men. A Pharisee who is just as strict about the law as it possibly can be, who abandons that and becomes the very thing that he hated and persecuted just a short time before, Paul. Amazing transitions that occur. And the Bible really is about that. We read in the beginning of the Bible about the Garden of Eden, in which everything was as it ought to be, in which there was this idyllic surrounding. They walked with God and they were fed and they were taken care of. And then in the very next chapter, we read about angels with swords barring their way, and about sin and death and all the destruction that comes from that. We read in the last chapters of the Bible about all of this sin and destruction and death, and about the misery and about the martyrdom and about the massacres. And then suddenly the very last chapter, there we are in the idyllic beauty of heaven again, with white robes and singing and the Son of God shining over all. Even in the life of Jesus, amazing how dramatic the changes are. There he is entering into the city, triumph, all the people shouting hosannas and laying down the palm branches. And then just within a few short days, those same people are cursing him and shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him, crucify him." It's not just Bible history that's like that either. Not that I'm particularly a student of any other history, but some of you are. And you recognize how quickly tragedy can change to victory and victory to tragedy, and how the affairs of state move swiftly from one direction to the other. And we look at history and even the history of our own lives is almost like that H.G. Wells time traveler, where the things just keep flipping by one after the other, one scene replaced by another, sometimes joy and sometimes adversity. Our lives are like that too, I think, though it doesn't seem to move so rapidly while we're involved in it. But sometimes it does. Some mornings we arise and everything is as it ought to be, and it is just that wonderful thing. One of Wanda's favorite movies, there's this scene while you were sleeping, and the father says, "You know, you struggle and you work with your kids, and then one day you get up and everything is just perfect." And his son says to him, "Dad, that's not this day, because I got news for you." That's the way life is. We think sometimes that it's going to go on the way it has always been, that the coming week is going to be just like the week past. Sometimes we look with boredom at the coming week and we say it's going to be just like the week past. And then sometimes when that week has come, we wish it was boring like the previous week was, because there's no telling what's going to be a part of that. Shakespeare was wrong. Noreen's not here tonight to disagree with me about that. Shakespeare was wrong when he said life goes on this petty pace from day to day down to the last syllable of recorded time, because life is filled with swift transitions. And that's what I want us to consider this evening. In some ways, this lesson is an extension of the one that we did 2 weeks ago, or last week, last Sunday morning, when we talked about providence. And I've been wrestling with that question, and how do we understand about our own lives and about God's role in them? And here's one of those things that troubles us. The transitions that occur in our life, the balancing of happiness and adversity, just the very thing that the wise man talks about here in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 14. And he gives us this advice about the life that we have before us. He says, in the day of prosperity, rejoice. And you think that's a pretty easy bit of advice. Let's just move past that one to the next part. But that's not so easy sometimes for us. We think we don't need anyone to tell us to rejoice in times of prosperity. What we need is advice about how to deal with adversity. But let's just stop a moment, as the writer does here, and say, in the times of prosperity, rejoice. And sometimes we fail to do that. Sometimes in the time of prosperity, we don't recognize that it's the time of prosperity, the time of happiness, the time of joy. It just doesn't seem quite as good as we thought maybe it was going to be last week. Doesn't seem as good to us as it's going to seem next week when we look back on it and say, oh, for those days when everything was going the way it ought to. Sometimes we just don't pay attention to the blessings. They are so great and so immense and so much a part of our lives that we don't rejoice in them as we ought to. We have children and we complain about how expensive they are. We have parents and we worry about how many rules they place upon us. We have a house and a job, and then we worry about the mortgage, and we worry about the fact that we have a boss that doesn't pay much attention to us, or we have too many hours to work, until, of course, you don't have children, or you don't have parents, or you don't have a house, or you don't have a job. And then we start thinking, wow, I should have paid more attention to the prosperity of that period of time. We are, as I have noted on many occasions, some of the wealthiest people who've ever lived in the history of the world. And of course, there's a wide range between those of us who meet here together at Antioch. But nonetheless, taken as a group, as an average, we're the wealthiest people, among the wealthiest people who've ever lived in the history of the world. Poverty has been the norm. We enjoy the benefits of technology, the benefits of freedom, and the benefits of prosperity in this world that most people have never enjoyed. And somehow it seems like that in the greatest periods of blessing, we just can't see them because we pay attention to the single thing that irritates us the most. Like a white sheet of paper on which there's a single black mark, and that's all you can see is the black mark that disfigures it. And the wise man says, in the day of prosperity, rejoice. We need to know how to rejoice when we are experiencing the blessings that God intends for us. Or sometimes we ruin these times of happiness with doubt. We think to ourselves, well, everything's going so well, it can't last. You know, there are people who are like that. They're waiting for the next shoe to drop, for the next bad thing to happen. Or maybe they feel guilty because they have too much happiness, too many blessings. There are people who feel like they start worrying when things are going along smoothly because what's the next bad thing that's going to happen? When's the bottom going to fall out? This is too good to last. We don't want to talk about enjoying our life because we're afraid maybe we're kind of like jinx it and lose it in some ways. Seems like it'd be a common kind of thread. Someone said when you ask a Scotsman how they're doing, they'll say, well, I'm just in my frail ordinary. They don't want to say they're doing great and they're in good health, just in my frail, ordinary state of health. And when you ask a Frenchman how things are going, they say just the common expression, pas si mal, not too bad. Don't want to say doing great. Don't want to jinx it in some ways about that. You ask an American businessman, how's business? Well, I can't complain. Because we don't want to say it's going great, because we're afraid somehow almost that will jinx it. In the days of prosperity, rejoice. Give credit to the Lord, but rejoice. And it would be okay, I think, if our attitude about that was merely a matter of respect for God and not a presumption on our part. But it seems like maybe it's almost a leftover pagan kind of idea that says, you know, you don't want to aggravate the jealous gods by being too happy, because then they will be envious of you. But the God that we serve is not envious of the happiness of His people. Rejoice in the days of prosperity. Be happy when times are good. Give the praise to God, yes, but be happy. But there is the other side of that in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And that is the day of adversity. And the advice that he gives in the day of adversity is consider. And you might say, consider what? But really, the admonition stops right there. In the days of adversity, consider, think about it. What does it mean? What can you learn? What can you do? Consider, ponder, think about its meaning, its lessons, and its outcomes. This is not an admonition to just do nothing and say, you know, I'm just going to wait here and suffer it out till it's all over. Consider, what does it mean? What is it that you can do about it? People are very frequently ready to make the worst out of a bad situation and just suffer stoically through it. But it might be made better if we consider the circumstances. One of the men that I've always been impressed with in the scriptures is the guy Benaiah. Benaiah, back in 2 Samuel chapter 23, is only mentioned in a few verses. He's one of the mighty men of David. And the lesson of Benaiah is a powerful one, I think, in some ways. 2 Samuel chapter 23 and verse 20. Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done mighty deeds, killed the two sons of Ariel of Moab. He also went down and killed a lion in the middle of a pit on a snowy day. He killed an Egyptian, an impressive man. Now the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a club and snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. These things Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, did and had a name as well as the three mighty men. He was honored among the 30, but he did not attain to the three. David appointed him over his guard. And I wonder about this guy Benaiah, and sometimes I think about him in terms of not attaining to the three. He was a member of the 30 mighty men, but he never did get to the three. That's a position designed to test men. There are plenty of people who in that situation would have felt that they were offended and they would have despaired because they didn't get the kind of recognition that other people did. They didn't quite get to the top. They were in good position, number 30, but not number 3 or 2 or 1. But Benaiah is a guy who takes advantage of the opportunities presented to him. I don't understand exactly what these situations are, but when you talk about killing a lion in the middle of a pit on a snowy day, it's not the most advantageous fighting position to be in. I don't know why he was down in that snowy pit with that lion, but he took advantage of the opportunity. He did the best that he could, and he won through. And the same thing seems to be true when he talks about the Egyptian, who is called an impressive man. An impressive man with a spear, and Benaiah, I don't know why he didn't have a spear. All he had was a club, but he went down to him, and he took his spear away from him, and he killed him with his own spear. He knew it's better to die fighting than it is to run. And so he went down in a day when it would have been not advantageous, perhaps, and other people might have walked away, but he fought his way through the adversity that he faced. Difficult fight in a difficult position in a bad time, but valiant men do valiant deeds in times of adversity. That's what makes them valiant. And Benaiah is the kind of fellow who does that. I don't know anything about his spiritual makeup, but I suspect that maybe the reason we're told about him is because he's the kind of fellow that Paul talks about in Romans chapter 8, the kind of person who understands if God is for us, then who can be against us? Doesn't matter that the Egyptian has a spear and all you have is a club. It is God's will. And so he would do that. He was able to make the best of a bad situation. What can we do in the times of adversity? Not just whimper and not just put up with it stoically, but to consider and to ponder. And what can we do to make it better? But maybe the thing that the wise man wants us to consider is this idea that he suggests God made them both. God made the times of prosperity and he made the times of adversity. This is where the providence comes in. God made them both for us. I don't understand the ins and outs of all of that and the whys and the wherefores. I don't understand the ordering or the sequence or the magnitude of those things, but God made them both. It seems as if in some ways he says they made one to go along with the other. That there's a sense in which we are not to discover what has come after us. because you never know what the next thing is going to be. But there is adversity and there is prosperity in every life. In the various translations, it's interesting the way this is expressed. God has made the one as well as the other. But some translations say God has set the one over against the other. God has set the one over against the other. Suggests a very different kind of idea rather than just God happened to make one and he happened to make the other. And God never just happens to do anything, but that he made them to set them one against the other, to balance them, as it were, against one another. That one corresponds to the other. That in every life, you're going to have these good things and you're going to have these bad things, and they're going to be a part of what life is all about. You can't separate the two of them in any life. There's a poem called The Crystal Moment by Coffin. And he sees the dogs chasing the stag. And the stag, of course, is ultimately going to die as the hounds are behind him. And he looks at that frozen crystal moment and he says, life and death upon one tether and running beautifully together. Life and death tied together. In many ways, that's what our lives are about. Prosperity and adversity tied together. There's no way to separate that. Not in any single life that is here can you separate out the prosperity and say, I'll take that and the adversity and I'll not have that. Those two things are part and parcel of every life. And in some ways, God has intended that it would be that way. Joy and sorrow are distributed in our lives as God would have them to be. I don't think that means that in every life that sorrow is reasonably proportionate with happiness. I think we can look at some lives and so far as we can evaluate it, some are on the whole happier and some are on the whole more sorrowful. I don't think that it means in life in general that there's an equality of happiness and sorrow. But it does seem to me there's some kind of compensation that God intends in all of this between happiness and adversity in a person's life. There's such relative terms to be happy or to be prosperous or adversity. And maybe in some way there's a final justice about what God gives to each of us that we don't have to wait until the final day of judgment to see it all become fair. I mean, there are people who are capable of exquisite pleasure in the things that they see around about them. Some people go through life relatively sodden and without any much appreciation for the rainbows or the sunsets or the taste of food. That's just who they are. But in some ways, maybe they don't feel the disappointments or the pain in the same way either. There are others who are keenly sensitive to all the good things in life, and yet they're keenly sensitive to the pains in life as well. Some people are kind of phlegmatic. They don't seem to mind them as much. It seems like in some ways that we look at some lives and we would be envious and say, you know, that's something. But as the proverb says, when riches increase, those who consume it increase as well. When you have lots of money, you got lots of people who want to help you spend that money. Some of the lottery winners have discovered that that was the case. Sudden fortune is theirs. And now all of a sudden they've got friends and they've got family and they've got relatives they never knew they had who are all very much dependent upon them. And it all disappears. Emerson thought about that too. And he said, the farmer imagines power and palaces are fine things, but the president has paid dear for his White House. That to be in a position of power like that, to be in a position of prominence, to have wealth is in some ways to have responsibilities and to have burdens that are placed upon you that in some ways maybe kind of balance those things out. I don't know. I had a different, well, kind of a similar, more prosaic maybe thought about that the other day. We were listening to the music on the Verizon on the TV, and you know, it tells you these little quips and bits of pieces about the artist. And this was particularly about Sam Cooke. And he had these hits in the early 60s, and then he died in 64. And I didn't think much about that. But then the next one came up was the same kind of pattern. And you think about all of those recording artists, particularly that period, you know, they were like shooting stars, like meteors. They were brilliant and they were popular and they were influential. And then they were gone, whether it was in plane crashes or whether it was because of their own sinful lifestyle. They just didn't last very long. Brilliant opportunities. Tremendous joy and prosperity, but balanced in some ways by short, painful life. Of course, that's not true of all of them. Elizabeth Taylor is still alive. I think she's going to get married again. She got married for the ninth time, but that means she's had eight divorces too. I don't think that's a happy life, even though that is a long life. And of course, there's Larry King. I don't know why exactly he's rich or famous, but he's getting divorced again too from his seventh wife. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I don't want anything to do with either one of those long, prosperous, and famous lives that those people have lived. That's not what I would call happy, really. Maybe there is kind of a balance, an averaging out in lives. I don't know. I wrestle with that about the circumstances that we face in life and whether it's fair or not. And I don't know how you measure what is fair or what's not in life. God has it in his hands. And the wise man says, in the day of prosperity, rejoice. And in the times of adversity, consider. Because God created them both, each one maybe balancing one another out, so that we may not know what the next day is going to bring. There is some purpose behind all of the things that we experience in our lives. We're not going to know the end, God says, of these things. Even if he balances the adversity and the prosperity in the world in some kind of equal way, you don't know which one is coming next. But that seems to be the point. You're not going to know whether tomorrow is going to be prosperous or whether tomorrow is going to bring adversity. And why has he done that? Why are these sudden transitions in life, these unpredictable changes that whipsaw us back and forth between happiness and sorrow in our lives? And I don't know whether I'm describing or explaining things the way that you experience your life or not. But it does seem to me that in many lives, it's hard to understand why there are these bad things and when they're going to occur and why these good things even occur to us or why they don't last. And the preacher here says it's because God does not want you to know what tomorrow is going to bring. He doesn't want you to find out what is after you. You cannot trust tomorrow. You cannot trust tomorrow, no matter how good your today is or how good your yesterdays have been, because tomorrow is a different matter. And you can't even trust it no matter how bad your current days are or how bad your previous days have been. That doesn't guarantee tomorrow is going to be good either. And it doesn't guarantee tomorrow is going to continue to be bad. You can't trust in tomorrow. You may have a feeling of certainty about today. You may have a clear remembrance about what yesterday was, but you have no idea about tomorrow. You don't know whether joy will persist or adversity will come. God's hand, however, is in it all. It's foolish, really, for us to try and make tomorrow out of our own stuff. In the days of adversity, consider. In the days of prosperity, rejoice. And we ought to be prudent and make reasonable plans about what we're going to do tomorrow. I don't doubt that at all. I mean, I'm a planning kind of fellow, and maybe to a fault. But you just cannot guarantee what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, there are people who plan so carefully. They plan for the next generation. They lay up in store for the next generation, and they intend that they're going to enrich their children and they're going to shape their lives for them. And how many rich people have placed stipulations on the trust they've left for their children? That they'll marry, but they don't. That they'll respect their parents and visit their graves regularly, but they don't. That they'll take the ashes into the boardroom with them, but they don't. I mean, you just don't know what the next generation is going to bring. You can't make that kind of planning. You can't plan for the future of your children. You may plan for 999 contingencies, and then the thousandth one that you didn't plan for is what thwarts your plans. And that's not just true about your children. That's true about the rest of your life, too. Oh, yes, we ought to make plans, and we ought to be prudent, and we ought not to be courting disaster by engaging in behaviors that we know are going to be disastrous. We shouldn't abandon planning, but it does put that planning in a realistic kind of perspective. You don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. God does. We ought to trust God. It is in His hands. We make prudent and reasonable plans, but we trust to the Lord for the outcome. Tomorrow belongs to the Lord. Whatever it brings, whether it is prosperity or whether it is adversity, it is in some ways from the hand of the Lord. As Job said in Job 2 and verse 10, should we accept good from the Lord and not evil as well? He understood in many ways about that. And he considered and pondered throughout that long book. He tried to consider what it meant. I don't know that he ever penetrated through to the heart of the matter any more than we will ever penetrate through to the heart of the matter in our lives and the adversity we've faced and whatever kind of adversity that may be. I mean, he experienced the whole gamut of it in, you know, huge, bigger than life kind of way. The death of his family, his children at least, the loss of his prosperity, the loss of his health, the loss of his friends as they questioned him and challenged him. And a little bit of everything about that some of us here know. I don't know any of us that know the full range of the adversity that Job faced, but every one of us has some of that element in our lives. Except evil from the hand of the Lord as well as you accept good. In the days of prosperity, rejoice. In the days of adversity, consider. It is really one of God's blessings that we live one day at a time. We have today to live. Tomorrow is obscure to us, and we cannot live tomorrow before it comes. Thus the advice that Jesus gave in the Sermon on the Mount, in that passage that Jason read just a moment ago, when he said that we ought not to worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. We can trust God and put our hands in the unchanging hand of God, which will not guarantee that there will be no more adversity, but will guarantee that we are able to survive that adversity. We can have the simple happiness of a child who's confident because his father is by his side wherever he goes and whatever he does. And friends may fail us and riches may fail us, but God our Father will not fail us. He is there wherever we are. David, who went through the kind of significant transitions that most of us will not face, understands that in the 139th Psalm. In the 139th Psalm, beginning at the very first verse, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up, you understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You've enclosed me behind and before and laid your hands upon me, and such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? There is no way that we could escape God's attention, His providence, His care for us, even if we tried. And why would we want to? In a positive way, Paul addresses the same issues in Romans chapter 8, in that great chapter on providence and God's love for us. He says in Romans 8 and verse 31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us, how will he not also with him freely give us all things. And then down in verse 36, just as it is written, for your sake we are being put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things, even this adversity, we overwhelmingly conquer through Him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. And this is the real joy of living, it seems to me. And the real strength for dealing with adversity is to know that we are in the Father's hands, and that He made the days of prosperity, but He also made the days of adversity, and that He knows and that He cares for us. Why do you worry about all of these things? Jesus said, your Father knows that you have need of those things. Oh, that we had the faith to know that that was the case and to live our lives in that way. Through all of the transitions of life, to put our hands in the unchanging hand of the Lord. Well, I hope that those thoughts are of some use to you. Has been an encouraging study for me. Those of you who are here this evening and you feel that you haven't been in obedience to the Lord as you ought to, whether you need to render obedience initially by repenting, confessing, and being baptized, or you feel like you have some public sin that separates you from the Father you need to make public confession of, we'd encourage you to make those things right as we stand and sing this song.